The Orb, Volume 2, Number 9. Obsolescence. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. Our story begins over 25 years ago with a calculator. I don't remember the act of acquiring the calculator, other than it could do hexadecimal and was really simple, the two things I needed. I don't remember how much I paid, but it would have been in the vicinity of $20. $20 in 1986 is worth a lot more today, but suffice it to say, this calculator was at the lower end of the price spectrum then. It's solar-powered. It hasn't cost me another penny since I bought it. I pulled it out just a couple of weeks ago to do my taxes. It works every bit as flawlessly today as it did in 1986. I've gone through 4 cars, 3 beds, and at least 2 cameras in that time. Each one cost tens, hundreds, even 1,000 times as much. I doubt I own very many things that have delivered more value for the price paid. And it's still working, just as it did when I bought it. I have a relatively new fridge. It comes with a 10-year warranty. So did my last fridge, the one that broke. My last fridge was about 8 years old. When it stopped keeping things cold, I dug out the warranty and found the number to call. The call would go to a local repair shop, apparently the only one serving a city of several hundred thousand people. It was here I learned that the warranty is little more than a mild assurance that the manufacturer took some care to make something that would last a while. I was told that it would be between 2 and 3 weeks to schedule someone to look at the fridge. They could identify what needed to be replaced, and then I'd likely be looking at up to 4 weeks to get a replacement part. There was no guarantee that that would be the correct part. So, the warranty could be honored if I was willing to wait a couple of months without a fridge. We've designed our products to look, and to some extent be, reasonably reliable. We write warranties that look good on paper. Ultimately, we've created more obsolescence. Yes, I could have had the old fridge fixed without having to pay money. I would have paid by not having a fridge for 2 months. I went out and bought a new one. Sad waste. I was born near the end of the baby boom. I remember as a child, things were well built and were expected to last. I think television was the first thing in my life that we expected to need to replace within 10 years or so. I know we replaced cars about every 2 or 3 years because we could, not because we had to. We sold our cars to new owners. Sometime in the 60s, disposable things started to appear on the market. Pens, razors, things like that. Before too long, there were disposable cameras. Landfill just didn't come into people's minds as we were living the good life. With that trend came a loss of craftsmanship. People stopped doing things as well as they could and started doing things just good enough.
Most folks spend their days daydreaming or finding clues. My whole life I've been here at the train station shining shoes. I started when I was 9, on my own and taught myself. No complaints, I'm doing pretty good and I got my health. Memories and calluses, my hearing's probably next to go. Sometimes I do a little handiwork for extra dough, but mostly this here is how I spend my time. And I've perfected a technique I call the dry shine. Some guys use lots of water on the shoe, but then when it's out in the open air, the shine is gone in 10 minutes. That whole approach to the job is dumb. In fact, dollars to donuts, that customer won't be coming back. This is the most common mistake of the amateurs, going for big numbers to satisfy their managers. Anyway, the dry shine, the first thing I mean to do in this part is very important. I clean the shoe, the residue, and no polish to keep the shoe from being ruined. All you need to do is use a rag with some cleaning fluid. If the shoe's all caked up with gunk, you need to think. The shoe can't breathe, and that's what causes the feet to stink. They took Carboin off the market, I believe it was a few years ago, cause that leather couldn't breathe. And once you've cleaned the shoe and it's dried, your base coat of polish can now be applied. Then you brush, cause what that tends to do is clean the shoe a little more, it gets rid of the residue, and then you do the second coat, just like the first one. You brush it, you rag it, and voila, your work's done, and that's it. You treat each shoe like it's special, care about your work, and be a professional. There's a right way to go about the rub and the wrong one. I find this way is much better in the long run. It ain't about the dollar or trying to go fast. Unless you take pride in what you're doing, you won't last. Craftsmanship is a quality that some lack. You gotta give people a reason for them to come back. It ain't about the dollar or trying to go fast. Unless you take pride in what you're doing, you won't last. Craftsmanship is a quality that some lack. You gotta give people a reason for them to come back. The world's a different place than what I was introduced to. They don't wear shinable shoes like they used to. Casual clothes in the office, what is this? The villain in sneakers is killing my business.
Annie Leonard presented the short film The Story of Stuff. In the following excerpt, she is introducing the arrow of consumption in the process from harvesting materials through to ultimate disposal. This arrow is called the golden arrow because it's the part we, as consumers, play, and it's the most important. The two guys she refers to are government and corporations.
And that brings us to the golden arrow of consumption. This is the heart of the system, the engine that drives it. It is so important that protecting this arrow has become the top priority for both of these guys. We have become a nation of consumers. The primary way that our value is measured and demonstrated is by how much we contribute to this arrow, how much we consume. And do we? We shop and shop and shop, keep the materials flowing, and flow they do. Guess what percentage of total materials flow through this system is still in product or use 6 months after their date of sale in North America? 50%? 20? No. 1%. 1. In other words, 99% of the stuff we harvest, mine, process, transport, 99% of the stuff we run through this system is trashed within 6 months. It wasn't always like this. The average U.S. person now consumes twice as much as they did 50 years ago. Ask your grandma. In her day, stewardship and resourcefulness and thrift were valued. So how did this happen? Well, it didn't just happen. It was designed. Shortly after World War II, these guys were figuring out how to ramp up the economy. Retailing analyst Victor Lebeau articulated the solution that's become the norm for the whole system. He said, our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfaction, our ego satisfaction in consumption. We need things consumed, burned up, replaced, and discarded at an ever-accelerating rate. President Eisenhower's Council of Economic Advisers chairman said that the American economy's ultimate purpose is to produce more consumer goods. More consumer goods? Our ultimate purpose? Not provide health care or education or safe transportation or sustainability or justice? Consumer goods? How did they get us to jump on board this program so enthusiastically? Well, two of their most effective strategies are planned obsolescence and perceived obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is another word for designed for the dump. It means they actually make stuff to be useless as quickly as possible, so we'll chuck it and buy a new one. It's obvious with things like plastic bags and coffee cups, but now it's even big stuff. Mops, DVDs, cameras, barbecues even, everything. Even computers. But stuff cannot break fast enough to keep this arrow afloat. So there's also perceived obsolescence. Now, perceived obsolescence convinces us to throw away stuff that is still perfectly useful. How do they do that? Well, they change the way the stuff looks. So if you bought your stuff a couple of years ago, everyone can tell that you haven't contributed to this arrow recently. And since the way we demonstrate our value is contributing to this arrow, it can be embarrassing. Have you ever wondered why women's shoe heels go from fat one year to skinny the next to fat to skinny? It's not because there's some debate about which heel structure is the most healthy for women's feet. It's because wearing fat heels in a skinny heel year shows everybody that you haven't contributed to that arrow as recently, so you're not as valuable as that person in skinny heels next to you, or more likely in some ad. It's to keep us buying new shoes.
Skinny lapels, wide lapels. Skinny ties, wide ties. Cuffs, no cuffs. Fashion. Instead of being about clothing us, keeping us warm, it's designed to be obsolete.
Christmas Eve 2050. choose between seven pony types. Some like swimming, we made those babies airtight. Robot ponies. Children, parents, spread the word around. Robot ponies, take your granny out to the robot pony geriatric ranch. Tennis, golf, and basketball. These robot ponies do it all. They fucking love it all. They'll tuck you in at night and sing to you.
Stuff we don't need, so we can drive that golden arrow of consumption. Consider the world of pharmaceuticals. Drug companies could research and find treatments for genuine ailments. Instead, they try to find ailments for whatever drug they've cooked up. Drug companies develop a drug with a range of physiological effects, none of which are terribly helpful. So the marketers must identify and promote a disease for the drug to treat. We are making being pretty well obsolete. They will co-opt a rare disease whose borders can be expanded to encompass more patients, or redefine an unpleasant aspect of ordinary life as a medical pathology. A classic drug industry example is the strategy developed by Merck in the 1960s to promote amitriptyline, its new antidepressant. At the time, clinical depression was regarded as a rare condition. So rare, in fact, that there appeared to be little profit in marketing an antidepressant. The solution was to increase the frequency of the diagnosis. To that end, Merck bought 50,000 copies of a book by Frank Oud called Recognizing the Depressed Patient and sent them out free of charge to general practitioners all over the country. Prescriptions for amitriptyline took off dramatically, despite the fact that a similar antidepressant, imipramine, had been available since the mid-1950s. The key to selling antidepressants, it became clear, was to sell clinical depression. 50 years ago, this kind of marketing was aimed mainly at doctors. Today, it is also directed at patients. The marketing buzzword is disease branding. To brand a disease is to shape its public perception in order to make it more palatable to potential patients. Take, for instance, restless leg syndrome. Until recently, restless leg syndrome was seen by clinicians as an unusual, somewhat mysterious condition. It was characterized by a crawling or aching sensation in the legs, often more severe at night, which could be relieved by movement, such as walking. It was not a common affliction. In 2005, however, GlaxoSmithKline got approval from the FDA to market REQUIP, a drug used to treat Parkinson's disease as a treatment for restless legs syndrome. GlaxoSmithKline soon issued a press release titled, "New Survey Reveals Common Yet Under-Recognized Disorder, Restless Legs Syndrome, is Keeping Americans Awake at Night." The REQUIP public relations campaign went on to suggest that problems such as insomnia and depression might actually be symptoms of restless legs syndrome, which tormented as many as 1 in 10 Americans. The second disease branding candidate is the shameful condition that can be destigmatized. When Pharmacia launched Detrol in the late 1990s, for instance, the condition it treated was known to doctors as urge incontinence. Patients called it accidentally peeing in my pants, and they were reluctant to mention it to their physicians. Pharmacia responded by rebranding urge incontinence as overactive bladder. This helped in two ways. First, whereas urge incontinence implied a kind of constitutional weakness and was associated mainly with elderly people, overactive bladder suggested that patients were afflicted by some sort of supercharged organ frantically working overtime. This shift from weakness to strength made the condition seem less embarrassing. Second, in contrast to incontinence, which meant actual loss of bladder control, overactive bladder was defined to include people who very often simply had a strong urge to go to the bathroom. The vice president of Pharmacia, Neil Wolf, explained his strategy in a 2002 presentation called "Positioning Detrol, Creating a Disease." By creating the disease of overactive bladder, Wolf said, Pharmacia expanded the treatable population nearly threefold, to a total of 21 million potential patients, the difference between a niche product and a mass market opportunity. By 2003, Detrol and its long-acting version, Detrol LA, accounted for $757 million in annual sales. It's not just that we're making being pretty well obsolete. We're also very careless about the drugs we use. As a patent is about to expire on a drug, the patent holder will tinker with the formula and announce the new version of the drug with a new patent. They can't let the old drug become obsolete. Drug testing in America is a curious thing. It requires that the drug being tested actually does better than a placebo without doing too much harm in side effects. It says nothing about the drug being any better than pre-existing drugs. The new drug may well be less effective than the old drug, and may even have a couple of new side effects. That doesn't matter. The FDA will approve it. Physicians read the ads in their trade journals and start prescribing the new drug because it is new. The old and possibly better serving drug that is now available as a generic goes by the wayside. Our culture breeds this sort of obsolescence. We have a culture of celebrity that chews them up and spits them out. We treat people as a resource to production that ignores their humanity and shuffles them out to be replaced by robots or cheaper people in other lands. Our value is being consumers, not producers. But how do we consume if we cannot also produce? Christine Fraser heads a four-generation family that was evicted from their home in DeKalb County, Georgia. The family included Christine's 85-year-old mother, herself, her daughter, and her 3-year-old grandson. They'd been under the protection of Occupy Our Homes. The eviction paperwork, filed in October of 2011, had elements of brazen fraud and was being pursued in federal court at the time. Sheriff Thomas Brown said police used intelligence to wait until the activists were not present at the home to guard it, and neighbors were asleep. Occupy alleges that police refused to allow Fraser to shower or for her elderly mother to get dressed and told Fraser to behave as if it were a fire drill. Again, acting as though a major crime was going down, police used 50 officers, blockaded the neighborhood, and wouldn't allow anyone to secure the family's valuable personal belongings from the curb. the raid happened at 3 a.m. The mortgage had changed hands 3 times in 6 months. The paper trail for the title had been broken, and the company that claimed foreclosure did not have the title. Years ago, a home mortgage was a long-term loan between a homeowner and a local financial institution. When things got tough, you went in and talked to a person who could listen and understand. You worked things out. Now, home mortgages are treated like gambling chips, brokered to the homeowner by some guy that gets a commission and heads for the door. The granting institution immediately sells the mortgage up the chain for their cut. It gets bundled with hundreds or thousands of other mortgages, and the bundle gets sliced up into tranches, the French word for slice. These tranches then get sold and resold. So who holds the note? Who holds the original promise to pay? It's not the broker. It's not the original issuing institution. It's scattered to the winds. If things get rough for you, who do you sit down with to work something out? Matt Taibbi wrote of the case of Natasha Leonard, who wanted to modify her mortgage after losing her job. The bank she spoke to offered to change her payments to $1,000 per month, up from an original $840. She's now employed and can make a reduced payment. However, the bank's lawyers are now in their 4th year of doggedly beating her brains out over minor technicalities in the foreclosure process. There appears to be no human being at the bank who's involved enough to issue a sane decision to end the costly battle. In this lunatic bureaucratic jungle of securitized home loans issued by transnational behemoths, the borrower-lender relationship can only go one of 2 ways, full payment or total war. Our relationships, business and personal, exist to serve people. When we make those relationships obsolete, we are lost. I'm a father. Nothing will ever make my daughter obsolete to me. I hope nothing will ever make me obsolete to her. Relationships, whether with family, friends, or co-workers, make our lives rich. People who claim to be able to measure happiness believe we were more than twice as happy in the 50s before the culture of obsolescence took hold. We valued people and thrift more than fashion and celebrity. Some cultures still do. We all know that we are consuming the resources of this planet much faster than they can be replenished. We consume in ways that foul the earth, water, and air. We do it for what? It's not survival. It's time to build an economy that addresses real needs in practical ways, that makes obsolescence obsolete. It starts with you. Pay attention to what you buy and think carefully about why you are buying it. Think about what you're throwing away and why. Don't be just a cog in the machine. Think. Is a listener-supported presentation of Cornoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.